I mean, if 2.5 million people spent 300 to 400 volunteer hours a year distributed in every congressional district, we would have full Medicare for all in 2 years or less. Why? Because the majority of the people want it. They don't like a kill or die healthcare system. Look at the prices of drugs these days. They don't like to be arbitrarily denied even when they have health insurance for corporate profits. So it's easier than we think. We really ought to have rallies. They just keep shouting. It's easier than we think to overcome this internalized sense of powerlessness that too many people have.
That's Ralph Nader, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Ralph Nader on Citizen Action, It's Easier Than We Think, Part 2. Overcoming adversity alone is a tough road to hoe, but when you act with others, it's not as difficult. There is nothing like solidarity. There's unity and strength in numbers. Most movements have very modest beginnings. Take women's rights. Elizabeth Cady Stanton and a handful of other women met in Seneca Falls in upstate New York in 1848 to launch the women's rights movement. The odds were against them. The naysayers were out in force with their patronizing comments like, "Why bother? Don't get involved. Get back to the kitchen." Yet those women and the many who followed them were able to achieve much. Struggles continue. Today, the hashtag MeToo movement is challenging patriarchy by calling out men for sexual abuse and harassment and insisting on equal pay for equal work. Citizen action is easier than we think. Ralph Nader, a legendary figure, has spent a lifetime fighting on behalf of ordinary people. The Atlantic named him one of the 100 most influential figures in U.S. history. Founder of Public Citizen, he's a longtime advocate for consumer safety and workers' rights. He's an eloquent spokesperson for single-payer health care. He's the author of numerous books, including Breaking Through Power and To the Ramparts. I talked with him at the American Museum of Tort Law, in his hometown of Winsted, Connecticut. Well, let's talk a little bit more about history and lessons from the past that can be applicable for today.
Well, I must say, with some exceptions, historians don't make as compelling a case as to how critical knowledge of history is for everyday life and the future. There are many examples in our own country where if you don't know history, you will, A, not be motivated to learn that people who had far less communication did wonderful things that we benefit from, like the farmer populist revolt in the late 1880s, which went into the Progressive Party and all the legislation and all the nice things that we like about this country produced. Or they won't know that they may repeat devastating tragedies because they weren't alert to how people made mistakes or allowed powerful forces to dominate their good conscience. Young people today have been lobotomized from history. I've never seen anything worse. When we were kids, our teachers would chide us. We didn't know much at all about ancient Rome and Athens. And now, if you say to young people, what do you think of the Vietnam War? They don't even say, what Vietnam War? They say, where's that? So it's really getting very serious. And I think the lessons of history, pro and con, are a huge motivation for civic democracy, alerting itself, foreseeing, forestalling, and strengthening its institutions. Why can't we learn from our forebears so we can be good ancestors? And so I just don't think the humanities are making a compelling enough case. I know they're on the defensive. Social studies teachers, civics has been downgraded in elementary school. Children don't learn how to how to use the tools of democracy. They don't learn civic skills. They aren't given civic experiences in the community under adult supervision the way they should. They just are told, sit down, look at the computer, and develop computer skills, not civic skills. And so where are the elders? Where are the arms around the shoulders? This is ridiculous. You say to people, you know, my teenage daughter, my teenage son, can't separate him from the cell phone. You're the parent. You pay the bills. I mean, the more parents are afraid of their children, we're going to lose a generation like we've never lost before. I know a lot of generations say the next generation is a lost generation. But you know what's coming. Virtual reality goggles, that's 4 or 5 years now from mass production. Watch millions of youngsters going around with virtual realities, climbing Mount Everest or lacerating the bully down the street or whatever. Look at automation, what's going on. So I think the older generation, whether they're part of parent-teacher associations, they got to take hold here. There's too much letting go. Just because the young know words and phrases and technical this and that that they don't know, that doesn't mean they don't have a responsibility to exert parental wisdom and discipline. It's not going to be done by administrative fiat. History is taught at home, not just at schools. I mean, my parents, when we came home from school for lunch, my mother narrated sequential historic sagas. Okay, you know, they were sagas, and there was, but it had a lot of historic fact in it. And my father would ask us questions like, what'd you learn today? Oh, Dad, we learned who discovered America. Who, son? Oh, it was Columbus. He said, Columbus, sit down, son. Columbus invaded America, killed the people who were there. There were plenty of people there when he, you say, were taught in school that he discovered America. That was a great lesson. And, you know, parental lessons are never forgotten. Our parents should just say, look, you're educated at home, you're trained in school, and you're excited by the library around the corner. Three-legged stool.
I was thinking also about the robber barons and their equivalents today leading to the progressive era.
Yeah.
As one example.
There are a lot of examples. I mean, when I started, you know, my civic tour, I went after the auto industry, I learned a lot from Eugene Debs. I learned how he talked, how he motivated, how he gave the accurate impression that he was never going to sell out, how he was resilient, what happened when he was fatigued. That was historical biography. And the same for the great muckrakers. I mean, I was 12, 13 years old. One ear was cocked to WINS listening to my New York Yankee game. And the two eyes, no television then, two eyes were reading Ida Tarbell on Standard Oil. They were reading all the great muckrakers, Upton Sinclair on the meat industry. I mean, I was excited beyond belief because to me, justice excited me. And that's what we got to do, because if you don't have fire in your belly for justice, it doesn't mind what you study at Princeton or Smith or Harvard. I'm telling you, I knew a lot of engineers who knew a lot more about auto safety engineering than I did. They didn't have fire in their belly. They just accumulated knowledge. And they weren't even employed by the auto industry. I lost a lot of friends in high school and college in traffic crashes. Right now, young people are 1/6 the probability of being killed in a traffic accident than what the case was when I was in high school. And if they weren't killed, they were injured, seriously, and disabled. In those days, disabled kids, they wouldn't allow them in schools. They weren't going to lift the wheelchair up the steps. They were out of sight, out of mind. And look at this great revolution, the disability rights movement. That's a consumer movement. That was never supposed to happen. Oh, we're not going to fix the pavements all over America for wheelchairs, and we're not going to have elevators. Well, now it's happened. So, you know, as they say, the blasphemy of the past can become the commonplace of the future.
What's that quote from Daniel Webster that you're fond of about justice?
Yeah, Daniel Webster, who was a senator from Massachusetts, but he also was a lawyer for the National Bank on the side. Those were the days. He once said, quote, "Justice is the great work of man on earth," end quote. I've sort of paraphrased it to, justice is a great work of human beings on earth. But it is true, without justice, there's no liberty and there's no freedom. What history teaches you is nuanced analysis of what words that are thrown around to manipulate people are. For example, freedom, defined by Eric Fromm, the psychologist from Yale, he said you got to divide freedom into two parts. Freedom from oppression, arbitrary authority, dictatorships, harassment, and freedom to be civically important, to matter in the shaping of local, state, national, international policy by government, to be powerful citizens, to have voice, to have clean elections, you see? So the rascals in charge of our kleptocracy and plutocracy and oligarchy, they like to talk about freedom from big government bureaucracy, which, by the way, they love when it services them for handouts, bailouts, subsidies, giveaways, special privileges in the marketplace, legal monopolies, and so on. I think it's very important to develop the study of justice per se. And believe it or not, in most law schools, that's considered intellectually soft. You know, the famous Judge Posner, Richard Posner, who's just retired from the federal courts in Chicago, he taught law at University of Chicago. And one student, this is an eyewitness account, Professor Posner, or Judge Posner, was one of the architects of the Chicago School of Economics, where everything is monetized, including adoption. I mean, these people went over the edge. And he walked into the class the first day, went to the blackboard, picked up the chalk, wrote the word justice, turned around, looked at the class, and he said, "You see that word?" I said, "Yes, Judge. I don't want to ever hear her again in my class." Because that's not monetization. That's not cost benefit. Our law schools are a big problem of the decline of democracy. They monetize, and they also give prestige to the corporate law courses. That's where the big money is, and not to people's law courses. I mean, when I took landlord-tenant at Harvard Law School, we hardly ever got to the tenant. There's no money representing tenants. There's money representing landlords. Labor law, that was down on the pecking order. Crime, criminal law, it was all street crime and domestic crimes. It was never corporate crime. See the bias? It was a reflection of the job market, where the money was for lawyers. I don't think people realize the extent of systemic lawlessness in this country, David, by the rich and powerful. They talk about street crime, burglaries, rapes, arsons, homicides, and so on. But corporate-caused homicides are far greater than street homicide. There are like 13, 14,000 street homicides every year in this country. How about, and we're talking about prevention now, how about 5,000 people a week dying due to preventable problems in hospitals? Who says that? Okay, it's a legitimate question. You should always ask, what's your evidence? What's your authority under the law? Johns Hopkins School of Medicine report in May 2016. And they said that was the smallest estimate they could come up with, and it was only in hospitals. That means deaths due to hospital-induced infections, malpractice, other preventable problems. You see any politician talking about that? We got to crack down on preventable casualties in hospitals? No. There are styles of violence And the ones you pay attention to are the ones that are sourced by the lower economic classes. And the ones that are ignored, like air pollution deaths, 65,000, according to EPA. Workplace-related deaths and diseases, OSHA, 58,000 a year. On and on. When they relate from corporate misbehavior, the laws aren't strong enough. The press doesn't report it enough. The enforcement is anemic. I just did an article for Lapham's Quarterly called Land of the Lawless. And it was printed in the Harvard Law Record that was distributed to all the faculty and the law students. I didn't get one reaction. You see, intellectually, law schools are tone deaf and stone deaf. There's no intellectual life at most universities. They have their own specialties, their own silos, but on the big questions between disciplines and specialization, very, very little. You can't get crowds out anymore the way you could for speakers who have something to say. I used to do 100, 200 speeches all over. They were hanging from the rafters. Can't even get the students out. They're into this. Text messaging their friends with important questions, to be sure, like, where are you? Have you turned the corner yet? What did you eat this morning?
What about points of resistance? What openings do you see out there that, you know, we can expand?
A lot of openings. Ordinary people, for a beginning. Look what the Tea Party did. In 2009, they showed up at town meetings arranged by senators and representatives who are used to arranging town meetings and 90% of the seats are empty. They filled the seats. They talked back. The members came back. I was there. They came back terrified. I would say, well, how many showed up? 100. How many in your district? 700,000. They changed the political dialogue. We were reacting instead of proacting to the Tea Party and right-wing republicanism. So people shouldn't minimize just a few people showing up at town meetings, personally confronting and interacting with their senators and representatives. I think a petition of 500 people in a state can get a senator to come in person to a meeting. That's how few people show up, and even less for a member of the House. Then some lawyers have got to stand up. Some of them have stood up heroically throughout American history. More should stand up, litigate, challenge, show people what their rights and remedies are, give them backbone. People are often afraid to enter the civic arena because they're fearing being sued, and the insurance companies and others hype that more than is actual reality. We have a community lawyer in Winston, Connecticut. Nobody in Winston is going to tell her that they're afraid to show up at a town meeting or a town council meeting because they're afraid of being sued, because she knows exactly how to rebut that nonsense. And if they are ever sued, she takes the case for them. That's one. Two, you got ordinary people. You got some of 1.2 million practicing lawyers. I mean, they should be the first responders to tyrannical forces. Third are the universities and the colleges. Ask yourself, where were the arenas where, other than the streets, where the civil rights and environmental rights, women's rights movements incubated? They were in college auditoriums. They were at Westland. They were at Berkeley. They were at University of Chicago. They were at Columbia. Why? Because usually the arenas are free and you had a lot of students there to fill the seats and faculty. So we have to reawaken. I know every time I say this, don't you know the students, they're rallying and they came out, not enough of them. I'm very avaricious when it comes to student turnout. I want 2% of them. 2% of them representing majority opinion of students. And you will see the media start paying attention to the subject. Of course, marches, rallies, pickets, sit-ins, all that really matters. It toughens people. They have that experience. It creates solidarity. That's why the history of solidarity is so important among unions, co-op organizers, civil rights fighters. It's very important to realize that there's a lot of people who came before you. So don't think you're alone. You're standing on their shoulders, even though they're never around. Do you know William Sloan Coffin, the chaplain from Yale and the great civil rights leader? He was arrested a lot of times in the South under some pretty brutish circumstances. And he was giving his last speech when he was afflicted with cancer at Riverside Chapel. And he looked out at this mass audience and he said to them, imagine our forebears. Imagine their courage. Imagine they're saying to you from the past, finish the job of justice.
Talk about some of these other groups that have developed in the last few years. Black Lives Matter, 350.org, hashtag MeToo.
Not enough elderly people. That's another point of resistance. We have millions of elderly people retired. Some of them are ailing and they can't get about. But there are plenty of them who are at these retirement centers, which could be incubations for peaceful revolution. And they're given a lot of leisure activities. And again, you remember the Grey Panthers. That was started by Maggie Kuhn, who was a social worker for the Methodist Church. And she was prematurely, mandatorily retired. And she was outraged. She was in her 60s. You remember the Grey Panthers. She stood up, one person, and she mobilized older people all over the country. And she said, I want you to do five outrageous things a day. And lo and behold, she was catapulted to the Tonight Show. She was on Johnny Carson several times. That would never happen today. She was on Phil Donahue. That would never happen today. There are no Johnny Carson and Phil Donahue shows. I used to get on the Merv Griffin and Mike Douglas show. They're gone. What's replaced them are these sadistic, masochistic shows with bouncers, you know. Disgusting use of our public airways, which we own but don't control, day after day in the afternoon. And I think we ought to arouse the elderly. They are possessed of more wisdom, of more experience. They have historical knowledge. And they shouldn't be marginalized because they don't know the latest gadget in Silicon Valley technology. Some of them can use the technology pretty well. So these are people who have time. They have perspective. And I think they have enough kinship with younger people in the neighborhoods to really have a higher estimate of their own significance in shaping the future. Posterity used to be a word among the early colonials in our country and founding fathers. Do you hear that much anymore? Posterity? They were very concerned about what they did then and what effect it had on their descendants.
Along that line, what we are doing now to our mother, the ferocious attack on the earth by predatory corporations, which is going to have an enormous impact on future generations in terms of climate change, economic and social devastation.
Yes, and that's motivating young people, especially on campuses, because it's in the news all the time, especially with manifestations of floods and storms and fires in California and elsewhere that have reached levels unheard of, and casualties as well. But you see, once again, we have to deal with nomenclature, David. I don't like the term climate change because we're not talking about a neutral climate change. Some climate change could be good, right? Suddenly rains in the Sahara. It's climate disruption. It's climate violence. It's climate flooding. That's the way we should talk about these words. Why do we use the words often of our adversaries? You know, the corporations don't like to say the corporate sector. They want the private sector. They don't want to say taxpayer handouts to big business. No, it's incentives so they can build the stadiums and the ballparks and charge us through the nose so you don't see many minority families in the stands watching minority players on the field. Have you ever had a semanticist on your program?
Well, Chomsky talks about language all the time.
Yeah, all the time.
Edward Herman and others, yeah. I mean, I think it's very important to control the vocabulary.
That's what he meant when he went on your show and talked about manufacturing of consent. Mm. Like, it's never the estate tax, it's the death tax, right? Not the estate tax. And the liberals are very bad about coining phrases. They don't even use the word corporate crime. They let people get away with white-collar crime. Where's the white-collar crime? Some bank employee embezzling the bank. That's white-collar crime. But the big corporate crime is Wells Fargo, embezzling from the American people, right? Creating fictitious accounts, credit card accounts, auto insurance sales, without even letting the customers know about it. Want to talk about premeditated crime. No corporate prosecution yet, by the way, of Wells Fargo.
Reminds me of what Bertolt Brecht once said about banks. He said the amateurs rob a bank. The real professionals establish one.
Yes. Who else said the best way to rob a bank is to own one? That was Professor Black from University of Missouri Law School. He was in the bank regulatory agencies. I think it was. Maybe it had an earlier derivation.
A lot of the, I'm going to use that term now, climate disruption. A lot of the climate disruption movement is powered by young people who are very concerned about what's happening to the Earth.
Won't you get more ears cocked and eyebrows arched if you use words climate violence and you show the storms and the floods and the fire as an elaboration? Well, why do you use neutral words when they're not neutral phenomena?
You're listening to Ralph Nader on Citizen Action. It's easier than we think. Part two of a special two-part program. This is Independent Alternative Radio. Let's go back to 1988 when the NASA scientist James Hansen testified in Congress for the first time that there was something seriously happening to the Earth's climate, and it was something that warranted attention.
What year was that?
1988. Yes. So 30 years ago, right? Barely covered at the time. Fast forward to a recent Guardian, A World on Fire, 124 degrees Fahrenheit in Algeria. These are temperatures. 122 in Pakistan, 108 in Los Angeles. The Earth is heating up.
And that spells deaths, fatalities, huge fatalities.
In the many thousands. The New York Times Sunday Magazine devoted a whole issue to climate disruption with this final coda. Since 1981, Arctic sea ice has decreased by an average of 1.3% per year. Since 1989, the global mean temperature has increased by 1 degree Fahrenheit. By 2030, so we're not talking about, you know, the 22nd century here. By 2030, the number of people worldwide affected by floods is expected to triple. Between 2030 and 2050, climate change, he uses the term, is expected to cause the deaths of roughly 250,000 people each year. By 2050, the Arctic Ocean is expected to be largely ice-free in the summer. By that same year, 1 million species will face extinction. By 2080, the frequency of heat waves in the New York metropolitan area is projected to triple, and by the turn of the next century, global sea levels will have risen by 1 to 4 feet, potentially turning hundreds of millions of people into refugees. Now, I just read that, and kind of in the middle of reading that, I kind of got numb myself.
You know, you want to get number?
A litany of of catastrophes.
It's spreading viruses, bacteria, infections. The range of the scourge malaria is now expanding. It's going into southern parts of the United States. So it isn't just inanimate things like floods and fires. And people are more scared by organisms that can give them lethal illnesses and create pandemics and epidemics. You know, I was thinking when you were reading that, what would be Donald Trump's response? It would be telling his grown children, quick, start a cruise line through the Arctic. There's more business now because it's all melted. They can go through the Arctic from England to Japan. So these deniers have commercial motives, you know. It's not just they don't believe the science.
But
they
you
have
know,
commercial motives.
But they have children. They have grandchildren. You would think that they would be concerned about their future.
Well, the insurance industry executives are. The insurance industry is really are pushing to do more about climate disruption. And I don't mean just building dikes so the ocean doesn't swarm into Jersey City or Miami. They are, in this area, very enlightened because they know that the claims are going to bankrupt them. Or they're not going to have people to do business with because they'll be gone. They'll be uninsurable along the littorals, you see. I was going to write a letter to New York Times Magazine about a little-known story. Three very rich people are champions of doing something about climate disruption. One is Al Gore, who's now very rich. He got in early on Google and all. The second is Tom Steyer, billionaire in California. And the third is George Soros, who was worth $35 billion. They all are right on the ramparts. Guess what? They're not on Congress. So this is another example. Because Congress is controlled by Republicans, a lot of environmentalists said, oh, Congress is hopeless. It's not where the action is. The action's back at the grassroots. I say, yeah, the action is at the grassroots. But who do you think is going to change energy policy in this country across the board, replacing fossil fuel and nuclear with renewables, solar, wind, geothermal, etc.? It's got to go through the Congress. That's not where the action is. So I write a letter to all three gentlemen. I says, you need to put $20 million a year and hire over 100 experienced scientists, engineers, lawyers, public relations people to go to Capitol Hill every morning, stationed in Washington, to start turning minds, making connections, connecting with people back home. Because, I told them, I don't know one single environmentalist who goes up every day on Capitol Hill on climate disruption. They've given up on the Republican Congress. See what I mean about indentured stupidity? There's no other word for it. So what's the answer from their offices? George Soros doesn't call back, you know. Their answer is, thank you for your letter, but that's not where the action is. We're putting our money at the grassroots. Now, how many people know that there's not one single full-time lobbyist going up on climate disruption? They testify once in a while. I mean steady parking the corridors of Congress, the House and the Senate. That's what our side is like. That's why the ExxonMobils keep winning. When I say to these people, Congress is not where the action is, pardon me. I say, when I'm up in Congress, you know who I stumble over? I say, who? I says, coal industry lobbyists, oil industry lobbyists, gas industry lobbyists, nuclear power industry lobbyists. I guess they know where the action is.
I guess one definition of insanity is repeating the same thing over and over and expecting different results.
It's also a definition of greed.
Well, speaking of greed, I've got a wonderful quote from 3rd century Confucian scholar. This is from Xun Zhu. I'm probably mispronouncing. Your Chinese is better than mine. Xun Zhu. The nature of man is such that he is born with a fondness for profit. If he indulges this fondness, it will lead him into wrangling and strife, and all sense of courtesy and humility will disappear.
You know what that tells you? The frailties and the virtues and strengths of human beings were recognized millennia ago. Why are people still watching Greek tragedies, Greek plays, Aristophanes, Euripides? Why do they watch Shakespearean plays? Aren't they out of date? We need to relish the wisdom of the ancients. So since you mentioned a Chinese philosopher, how about this? Chinese philosopher in the 14th century said, quote, to know and not to do is not to know. obviously, it can be criticized. It's got a lot of validity in it. Our society has far more solutions on the shelf that are not applied to the problems on the ground. We know what to do about climate disruption. We know what to do about housing. We know what to do about living wage. We know what to do opening access to the courtrooms. We know what to do about fair taxation. We know what to do about full Medicare for all, but we don't do it. And so I'm great on aphorisms from the ancients, Confucius, Lao Tzu, the great Islamic philosophers, Judaic philosophers.
Gore Vidal used to talk about Confucius. Supposedly in the Analects, Confucius said if he were given one thing to do, if he had power, he didn't want power, it would be to rectify the language.
Exactly. Again, I forgot to mention the Buddhists and the Hindus.
Well, in the time remaining, let's talk about the future of work with the advent of artificial intelligence and automation. What are jobs going to look like in the coming decades?
You know what they don't talk much about? Non-work. Because as the machines replace people, the workers should have capital participation in the technology that replaces them. The capitalists shouldn't own all these machines as they lay off all the workers. And they're not just blue-collar workers anymore. They're white-collar workers, graduates from Smith, graduates from Wellesley, graduates from Cornell, from Stuttgart University. You know, a lot of white-collar, upper-class, well-to-do people think it's not going to affect them. It's already automating legal work, putting paralegals out of work. It's automating reporting in some areas. And there's no stopping it unless we say it is stoppable. Because you hear this comment, it's basically going to happen. You can't stop it. It's inevitable. Well, people have got to talk not only about the plight of workers today, misery, mass poverty. You know, half the families in this country are poor. You know, you can't have an average family with father, mother, and two children be anything but poor if they're making under $47,000 a year gross. And that's half the families. So here we are, the home of the brave, land of the free, biggest country in the world, biggest economy, and we're pushing more and more people into third world status, institutionalized poverty. So I want people to talk about what's going to happen when the jobs are gone. And what's going to happen is, one, and even some Silicon Valley companies are supporting this because they see the future in terms of automation, a universal basic income where everybody gets, what, $15,000, $20,000 a year. And that can be funded if we get rid of a huge amount of undertaxation of corporations and all kinds of other things, taxing bad things and taxing crime, corporate crime, pollution. It is not anything that can be throwing our country into massive debt for the future to inherit. So that's one, universal basic income. Nixon proposed, Milton Friedman, conservative economist, proposed it. There's a whole history of liberal and conservative economists and politicians supporting it in the past. The second thing I really wanted them to talk about more is the ownership of capital. People no longer can make it on wages. They have to have part ownership in capital investment. The share of the economy in the last few decades that goes to labor has been shrinking compared to the share that goes to capital, investors, Wall Street. That's a very serious danger sign. So we have to put more capitalists in our society. The problem, as someone once said, with capitalism is that there are too few capitalists. And the third is to redefine culture enjoyment and the pursuit of happiness. There's a fellow who ran against Senator Cardin of Maryland a few weeks ago in the Democratic primary. His name was Jerome Siegel. And he literally sold his Apple stock, he got in early, and put $500,000 of half-page ads in the Washington Post and Baltimore Sun of essays challenging Senator Cardin for his reactionary corporatist warmongering views and putting forth a theory of work. And basically, he believes in simplifying our culture and focusing on the pleasure of work, the pleasure of leisure, the joy of work, redefining what work is. I mean, why in a immensely mechanized, productive economy do people have to work 40, 50, 60 hours a week, and they now work at home without being paid in the computerized world, you know, to make up and to catch up? So that's what we need. Big picture stuff.
Well, you mentioned the number of poor people in the country. There's virtually no political discussion of the poor. It's all about the middle class, and one of the huge drains on people today are the rents, which are unaffordable. 40, 50, 60, 70% of people's incomes are going to rents, to housing. Affordable housing has become a kind of catch term, but there's very little of it available.
What does that say about market theory, David? They say if there's big demand, there should be expanded supply. Well, not only is there big demand for housing, but the expansion of housing is massively subsidized by taxpayers. The Federal Housing Administration, all kinds of mortgage guarantees, right? So where are our housing capitalists? Why aren't they expanding? Why aren't they building more affordable housing for Silicon Valley entrepreneurial staff who are making 120 grand a year, can't even afford rent in the San Francisco, San Jose area? So you see that the corporate capitalists have got a lot to answer for.
Talk about the gig economy, another aspect of contemporary capitalism. Fully 10% of the U.S. workforce is now contract labor. I guess they're supposed to feel good. They're called contractors.
Part-time contractors.
Yeah, these are casual work with no benefits, no vacations, no health care, no nothing. And that's a growing sector of the economy.
No,
the Uberization of the U.S. economy.
Well, I get into a cab in Washington, the first thing I say to the cab driver, down with Uber. Because these are full-time jobs, these cab drivers. They can barely make a living. They're lucky if they make $30,000 a year gross, and they work their heads off in congested traffic. And so along comes Uber and opens it up to thousands of people who actually often are losing money because they don't expense it right. They think it's just spare money. Some of them are buying cars to qualify. They don't expense it. They don't look at it like a business. And Uber, once they hook them, turns the screws. They get a higher percentage, and they start squeezing them. And of course, they, as you say, there are no benefits. There's no pension. There's no insurance. They circumvent local taxi regulations, and it's unfair competition. So I'm not supportive of the so-called gig economy, which makes people enormously rich that are thousands of miles away who are pulling the strings here. And by the way, a lot of these gig economy cab riders, they don't know where to go in the city. They're relying entirely on GPS, and they're very often inexperienced in traffic. They have more than their share of traffic crashes. You don't know who they are when they get you get in the car, but Uber and Lyft knows exactly where you're going and has it in a database to further invade your privacy and send your traveling habits to corporations to put you on their, so we say, mailing list and telemarketing intrusions when you're eating your supper.
Have you been following what Mayor de Blasio is doing in New York in terms of capping the Uber drivers?
Well, he lost the first round because, you know, they can marshal a lot of Uber drivers surround City Hall and protest. But he has now limited them. But let's put it this way. To be fair, the cab industry brought a lot of that on themselves with these medallion barriers in New York City, costing $500,000 to become a cab operator. You know, you have to pay, you have to borrow money to pay for a medallion. So they had a kind of quasi-monopoly, and they brought it on themselves. All right, now it's broken, the monopoly. Now the poor cab drivers are on the defensive. They are the supplicants. So we don't want to go overboard, but what de Blasio, the mayor of New York, did was he said, okay, we're going to let some thousands of cab drivers for Uber and Lyft and others to work the streets of the boroughs where there are fewer traditional cabs, but we're not going to so expand the number that even these drivers can't scratch out much for their time working for Lyft or Uber.
One of the signature New Deal pieces of legislation was Social Security, established in 1935. Today there's a lot of fear-mongering going on about, well, there'll be no, when you're ready to retire, there'll be no money there or be very little. Yet this has been called the most successful anti-poverty program in the history of the United States. Where does Social Security stand today?
Well, first of all, it's vulnerable to the Republican Party's platform of social insecurity. They want to privatize it, which means that's another soft word, right? They want to corporatize it, put it in the stock market, have it go up and down, or take the crash. So that's one. The second is, as long as the economy grows 2.5-3%, there's enough reserve to keep paying fully Social Security. If it sinks under that, and we don't have young paying labor with automation, its reserve is going to go down so that maybe in 10, 20, 30 years, it's going to start going into the red. Not that you don't get your full Social Security check, but you get less of it. And we have to be very careful of that. The other thing is, with Democratic Party complicity, the Republicans got through Congress a provision where the U.S. government could reduce its annual deficits by borrowing from the Social Security Reserve and putting a Treasury bond IOU in response, right? So now, instead of trillions of dollars in reserve, it's nothing but a U.S. Uncle Sam Treasury bond IOU, because the deficits are lower than they would have been if they didn't hijack, for IOU purposes, the Social Security Reserve. Now, you know, that's why you have AARP once in a while shouting caveats, warning, beware. Social Security could be put into real trouble.
Well, again, you'd think that would be an issue to galvanize enormous political support, the security in your twilight years.
Well, it does. I mean, you know, politicians do lose votes if they're not...
Well, it used to be the third rail of American politics.
Yeah,
no more.
Yeah, it's less of that. They're trying to pit the young generation against the older generation, saying, look at these elderly people in America. They get all this social welfare and money, and all you get are student debts. That is true, but not... You don't do that at the expense of older people. They paid in. You do that at the expense of Wall Street that tanked the economy and unemployed so many of the younger generation, sometimes for a long time, and drained the public treasury for corporate bailouts so that there couldn't be tuition-free higher education or lower student debt burdens with lower interest.
This question comes from a friend in Boulder who asks, can we regulate capitalism enough under the current corrupt political system to bring about needed changes? If not, must there be a nonviolent revolution? Can you imagine there being a progressive revolution in the United States?
No, yes, and yes to the three questions.
Explain.
The corrupt political system is the barrier, for example, Congress. Can you open up Congress with a nonviolent revolution? I would say with 2,000-3,000 people in each congressional district performing a civic hobby called a Congress watchdog group, or what I am about to call Congress rat watchers, in a fable that I'm about to publish called How the Rats Reformed the Congress. And it's a bottom-up reform, literally. When nonfiction doesn't work by exposing Congress, you got to use fiction. Anyway, it doesn't take all that much to mobilize congressional districts to change the Congress and open up transformation of our political economy, if not our culture.
I want to conclude with some discussion about art and the importance of art in struggle and also in enriching our lives. Novels and poetry, and I know in your book you quote the Marge Piercy poem, The Low Road. Maybe you could read that, actually.
Oh, yes. This is really a nice little excerpt from a poem called The Low Road by Marge Piercy. Quote, "It goes on one at a time. It starts when you care to act. It starts when you do it again. And they said no. It starts when you say we and know who you mean. And each day you mean one more." End quote. Yeah.
To expand on that issue of art and the importance of art in daily life, music, theater, I think if you want to understand capitalism, Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman, it's all there.
Yeah.
You know, and those kinds of examples of, you mentioned Upton Sinclair, The Jungle. People are reading The Handmaid's Tale today by Margaret Atwood. And art is a central part of our existence and our humanity. What do you turn to in terms of art? Is there particular music you listen to, reading, novels, poetry?
Nature, forests, sunsets, beaches, rippling lakes, churning rivers, waterfalls. That's plenty for me.
I'm going to close with a quote from Howard Zinn. "We don't have to wait for some grand utopian future. To live now as human beings should live, in defiance of all that is bad around us, is itself a marvelous victory." Thanks very much. Thank you, Ralph.
And I want to thank you. I want to thank you, David, because for decades you have provided serious talk from people who are shut out from the mass media, but have a reputation of being wise, of being compassionate, and of being accurate in their analysis and their foresight.
Thanks very much. You were just listening to Ralph Nader on Citizen Action, It's Easier Than We Think, part two of a special two-part program. I talked with him in Winsted, Connecticut. Ralph Nader, a legendary figure, has spent a lifetime fighting on behalf of ordinary people. Life magazine ranks him as one of the most influential Americans of the 20th century. He rose to fame in the 1960s when he took on General Motors and its unsafe Corvair car. His 1965 book, Unsafe at Any Speed, not only created a sensation, but was also instrumental in the enactment of the Motor Vehicle Safety Act. He has exposed the misdeeds of the corporate sector as well as the political system. He's the author of numerous books, including Breaking Through Power and To the Ramparts. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization, Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Noam Chomsky, Arun Gupta, Tariq Ali, Vandana Shiva, Jeremy Scahill, and Abby Martin. We also have a series of Ralph Nader programs. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. Special thanks to Charlene Lavoie. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.